Good morning once again, and welcome to The Other Side of Midnight. I'm your host, Richard C. Hoagland, and for the next couple of hours, between that magic time between dusk and dawn, we're going to explore something really interesting tonight. But before we get to that and my guest, I want to discuss a couple of important things that are happening tomorrow morning. As you may or may not know, we have been tracking a couple of space missions, both the Dawn mission to Ceres, the little asteroid dwarf planet between Mars and Jupiter, which we are now orbiting with an unmanned ion-powered spacecraft. And they just sent down on Wednesday an astonishing view of this crater, the 60-mile-wide crater called Akator. And in the center of that crater on the floor, there appears to be, from all the people that I've now run this by, who say, "Oh my God, look at that," there appears to be the geometry of one and maybe two ancient domed cities. Now, today, almost kind of like in response, you know, ping pong, the New Horizons team, which, as you know, a couple of months ago sent the New Horizons spacecraft flying past Pluto and getting us some extraordinary images from that extraordinary distance, they released new images today all over the web. And this afternoon, because it is Friday, they're going to be holding a press conference at NASA headquarters, I believe, and we should get some even additional imagery, much higher resolution. Well, my producers and my crack staff and all the folks in the back room and a lot of people that you may recognize and a couple that you may not are going to be here tomorrow night in a roundtable featuring Will Farrer, Robert Harrison, Andrew Curry, and our good old friend Keith Laney, and we're going to be presenting a kind of a dog and pony show in radio with pictures of images and enhanced images of these extraordinary structures, both on Ceres and on Pluto, that you should not miss. In fact, you cannot miss. This is the captain speaking. You will be here tomorrow morning. You will pay attention carefully. Now, before you get here tomorrow morning, I want you to do something. I want you to go to our website, othersideofmidnight.com. That's othersideofmidnight.com. Scroll a little bit down, and you will see for the first time in the run of this show, we're actually listing tomorrow's program, tomorrow morning show. And under that, tomorrow morning show with the guests I just outlined, there is a link. It says View and Download Press Release. We have written a press release because the imagery that we're going to be discussing and presenting and analyzing is so profound and represents a turning point, such a significant turning point in the NASA history of kind of keeping what's really out there secret, that I want as many people around the net, around the web, to know what we're doing as possible. So what I would like you to do, the thousands and thousands of you that are listening and you're adding by the day. I mean, the numbers are extremely interesting, and obviously our reach is expanding by leaps and bounds. I want all of you with a computer or a smartphone or a device, a tablet, whatever, I want you to download that press release and send it to your friends. Send it to everybody you think might be interested. Grandmothers, daughters, girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever. I want you to send this out as wide as possible, because the size of our audience tomorrow morning may in fact condition or determine or influence the NASA reaction in the next few days in terms of giving us better data and maybe finally officially owning up to what is there. Now, this is the first time I've asked you to do something kind of for yourselves, because the more we put pressure as a political force, as a coherent entity on NASA, the more at this critical time, I believe, we may reach a very interesting tipping point. We may tip them over the cliff into disclosure land, where they actually tell us the truth. Now, there are no guarantees. The only guarantee that I'm offering is tomorrow morning is going to be really astonishing, because Keith and Will and Andrew and Bob have been doing an amazing yeoman's job behind the scenes, preparing this imagery in a way that you will be able to see it. We're going to have actually obliques and 3D projections, for those people that are not used to looking at ancient archaeologies on distant planets, this is going to be for you, because you're going to have a tour de force of what NASA has been keeping secret for 50, 60 years. Namely, we live in a solar system where someone at some point lived before and left us extraordinary stuff. And the evidence, it will be on your screen tomorrow morning. If you actually, from the other side of midnight page, go to our guest this morning, Tim Wallace, if you click on his name, that will take you to the next page, which is his page. And right at the top, under Radio with Pictures, you will see, Rich has put up there, a link to the latest New Horizons images that were released today. And frankly, they're pretty mind-boggling. You'll have a lot of fun in the next 24 hours looking through those pictures and following the links and all that. But the real show, the real place to be, you know, be there or be square, as they used to say, is going to be tomorrow morning, this show, The Other Side of Midnight, starting at 12 a.m. Pacific, because we're going to give you something that you will not be able to get anywhere else in terms of the background story of what NASA has finally put out there for us to view. Okay, with that out of the way, I'd like to segue nicely to my guest this morning, the Irish-born, internationally known author and lecturer Tim Wallace Murphy. Tim is the author of 13 published books. I feel secondary. Mostly about the history of a variety of heretical terms and forms of spirituality. He once redefined heresy as the use of God's gift of free will in matters of religion, faith, and dogma. 11 of his works describe the historical aspects of spirituality and cover a variety of themes, including the Knights Templar, the Cathars, Rosin Chapel, and the Western esoteric tradition, as well as the Grail genre. We do not have enough time to get into the really cool stuff, so obviously this is merely a tease. The other two, including the most recent, are more modern mainstream historical works, namely What Islam Did for Us, a study of how Islamic scholarship laid the foundations of most of the more valued aspects of European culture, and then his latest work, The Genesis of a Tragedy, a brief history of the Palestinian people. Tim has was provoked to write this work as the Palestinian side of the conflict is rarely heard in either Western Europe or in the United States, and if the ongoing running sore in the Middle East is ever to be solved, the pain on both sides must be understood. So with that, Tim, good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
It's great to be with you.
You are speaking to us this morning from one of the most extraordinary places, I think, on the entire planet, the south of France, and you're just a stone's throw from Rennes-le-Château.
Yes, son, I'm about 4 miles from Rennes-le-Château, maybe five. I had lunch there with friends yesterday, and the whole area of the Languedoc is magical.
Absolutely.
It's a wonderful mountainous region. Every valley is different, and every town and village has its own traditions, which they very proudly uphold. And the people are marvelous.
So how did a good Catholic Irishman wind up in the south of France?
Well, first of all, I'm not a good Catholic Irishman.
Oh.
My mother was a French Jew who emigrated to Ireland as a young child to escape anti-Semitism in France. My father was an Irish Catholic. When they married, neither family would speak to them because they'd married outside the faith. So my brother and I grew up in splendid isolation. The best description of me would be as a Franco-Irish Yiddish boy who survived a Catholic education. Now, if you want to grow up spiritually confused, that's a pretty good way to go.
Well, I guess we kind of share some of the same background, because I was a Catholic, but I grew up a heretic, and I've asked all kinds of questions, very, very impertinent questions sometimes. And I remember somewhere around sixth or seventh grade, I was sitting in a Catholic school, and I had this sudden kind of epiphany, which is, what is all this really all about? I mean, it was one of those things where it suddenly comes over you that everything you've taken for granted, you kind of need to look at a very early age. And of course, that was the end of me, because I've been asking these damn fool questions ever since.
Well, that's a process which, thank God, never stops.
Hopefully.
Spirituality is very, very different from religion.
Of course. Go ahead.
The difference was defined by a Jesuit once, who was asked, what is the difference? And he said, to answer that now, I've got to tell you a little story. Spirituality is represented by a spring that arises naturally at the top of the mountain, and it symbolizes God's love for all of creation. Under God's wonderful invention of gravity, it trickles down the mountainside and sustains and strengthens and refreshes everything it touches. Now, religion, that's something else again. That's the well-intentioned man-made plumbing, which usually makes the water go uphill where it shouldn't go, and will usually whistle it past your ass without the benefit of a tap. Being man-made, it always pollutes the water. So if you have any doubts, my son, go back to the spring, which is what an awful lot of people have been doing for a very long time.
So with that background, you know, mom and dad and families kind of confronting each other, sounds like the Hatfields and McCoys, kind of. What got you onto the path that you're on, which is trying to figure out the underlying spiritual foundation of everything, I guess?
Well, like everybody else, I came to a spiritual path through intense personal pain and confusion. And I started following my first spiritual path some 45 years ago. And slowly, I began to change. It's a transformative process. I'd always wanted to be a writer. When I gave up medicine, I announced to the waiting world that I was giving up the profession to become a writer. And I made this announcement in a pub, a bar in Dublin. Mm-hmm. And standing next to me was a writer called Brendan Behan. And he said, well, Timmy, every Irishman's got a good novel in them, and that's usually the best fucking place to keep it. I didn't write a damn thing. I wandered around the world for many years, went back to university, qualified as a psychologist, and one of my clients described himself as a burnt-out writer. He was a wonderful, warm man called Trevor Ravenscroft, and we became very close friends, and just before he died, we wrote a book together, and I discovered what I was here for, and I've been doing it ever since.
With 13 books to date, and obviously many more planned.
Well, 14, actually. There's another one on the way.
You're like Asimov. I could never keep up with Isaac, because every time I met him, he's written a new book.
Yeah, well, it's an obsessional way of living. You see, you talked about asking questions. That's what it's all about. And every time you ask a question, you don't so much get an answer, you get three more questions.
Yep.
And it goes on. And it's fun. It's fascinating.
Well, this obsession, you know, magnificent obsession, I guess we could describe this as, has sure encompassed a lot of work. I mean, you've written on the Templars, the Cathars, Roslyn Chapel. I would not know where to begin, because I actually want to talk about your second most recent book, because that's kind of appropriate for this morning. But just briefly, how did you wind up getting into the underpinnings of secret traditions and rituals and the machinery behind the facade?
Through my contact with Trevor Ravenscroft.
Oh, okay.
He'd written a book, which was a sort of cult book in the 70s, a book called The Spear of Destiny.
Oh, yes, of course.
And he'd written a far more important one, which is still in print, called The Cup of Destiny, which is an explanation of Wolfram von Essenbach's Grail Saga, Parsifal, as a guide to initiation. Now, I wasn't totally convinced about that, but when I saw Joseph Campbell's Power of Myth series, Campbell was asked about the Grail. And Campbell said, well, why should any medieval knight go out and search for a relic, however holy, when all he needs for a miracle is to cross the road and go to church and go to communion? And he partakes directly of the body of Christ. He said, no, it's a coded guide to initiation. And to back up his argument, he cited a passage from the Gospel of Thomas, where Jesus is quoted as saying, he who drinks from my mouth...
Hello, this is Rich. I'm not available right now, but you can leave me a message
at
the date and time, and I'll get back to you when I can. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. And Campbell quoted a passage from the Gospel of Thomas where Jesus says, he who drinks from my mouth, I will become he, and he will become me. Now, think about that. It's mind-boggling. Now, the secret tradition in Europe says that Jesus did not come to redeem us from sin, but to reveal a pathway of initiatory spirituality, a pathway to enlightenment. And this is encoded in all the great cathedrals and churches in Europe, in secret code, which, if you're an initiate, you can read. So the message was passed down, despite church repression, for over 2,000 years. And
was this,
it's the whole point of Jesus' teaching.
Was this why the Cathars got on the wrong side of the Vatican and then all those terrible things ensued?
Very similar reasons. They followed a similar path, somewhat different in some of its belief structures, but basically the same idea. Again, it was spirituality. And the church started to lose money. Now, the church has never been about spirituality. The church has been about political control from day one, ever since it married up with the Roman Empire.
A la Constantine.
Yeah. And after that, there two things were, you weren't allowed to disagree with church dogma by as much as a dot or a comma, or you were invited to the next church barbecue and you were on the menu. So people kept quiet if they believed something else or if they started to question. They did it very secretly. And other traditions were passed down throughout Europe. And those traditions formed the Western esoteric tradition. And it's a fascinating study because it's the clash between church belief and the Western esoteric tradition that has actually spawned the society we live in.
Well, the church, of course, from my position as a Catholic, when I was a Catholic a long time ago, kind of, I mean, in the words I would use now would be the church was like the institutional, bureaucratic force or intermediary between you and God. In order to the church, you had to go through the church to get to God. And what spirituality is, of course, is a direct line. It's Skype on steroids.
Well, it's even more distinct than that. The church is accepting a body of belief that somebody else has told you. Spirituality is not accepting any beliefs. It's a case of understanding your own personal experience.
So it's basically democracy versus
It's personal experience rather than do as I tell you.
Which, of course, would be very threatening to an institution that lives by having lots and lots and lots of people who do what they tell them.
Yeah. The church demands unquestioning obedience, both from its own clergy and from its people. Whereas in the ancient Greeks, for example, they thought that sin arose from ignorance. So if you could educate people to learn about the good, the beautiful, and the true, they would not sin. This was the total reversal to the church, who said, keep the people in ignorance. Don't forget, until very late on in European history, the kings, the emperors, and the nobles were all illiterate. The only people with a little bit of education, and that was limited, were the priesthood. And this allowed the church to become totally dictatorial, which it stayed. You mentioned the Cathars earlier on, and this area. Well, this is the area where the Inquisition was born to help suppress the Cathar religion. And the Inquisition is still with us.
You mean there in southern France?
No, it was here that it was founded, but the Inquisition still exists. Only it's under a totally different title. It's called the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith.
Okay.
And it was headed until fairly recently by Cardinal Ratzinger, who was known as God's Rottweiler.
Hmm. And we all know what happened to him.
Yeah, he excommunicated more devout Catholic theologians than his predecessors had done for a couple of centuries. So nothing's really changed.
Whoa. Back up and tell us that again.
Ratzinger excommunicated more devout Catholic theologians in his brief period of office as head of the Inquisition than his predecessors had done for a couple of centuries.
Okay,
what's changed?
Yeah, well, the first question I have is, how come we don't know about that? That's not part of his resume.
Because it's a matter of record, but you have to dig for it. The church does not publicize the fact that it is still a repressive organization. For example, as head of the Inquisition, Ratzinger was the cardinal who issued instructions that cases of pedophilia should not be reported to the state.
Hmm.
And that may well have a bearing on his resignation as Pope.
I was going to get to that, because he also, in this unique situation, is the first Pope in, 1,000 years or so to have resigned?
Yes.
And you think that that's because of his background?
It might well be. We don't know. This is the problem.
Do we have speculations? Do we have
have reasonable speculation that it is to do with the way he handled the pedophilia crisis when he was head of the Inquisition.
Hmm. Well,
so
that's
speculation. It's not fact.
Okay. Well, we do know that it's incredibly rare that a pope resigns. So something big. I mean, the mainstream story was, he just kind of got tired.
Yeah. Well, you still believe in the Tooth Fairy or Father Christmas?
If I did, I would probably not have some NASA images I was going to show you later. But anyway.
Yeah.
So if we can interpret that resignation and the election of a new pope, we're talking about turning a major institutional page in this horrible history?
Possibly. Or we either turning a major page or doing a lovely piece of covering up.
Hmm. I can see you really believe.
Time will tell.
You really believe in the institution, I can tell.
Don't underestimate the institution of the Catholic Church. Its prime achievement is survival.
Well, for thousands of years, yes.
Yeah, 2,000 years. And it will survive this.
So you've done a range of books, 11, 12, 13, 14, now 14. The Knights Templar, obviously in a very similar position to the tragedy of the Cathars, except it's much better known.
It's better known, or certain aspects of it are better known. Don't forget, when the Templars were suppressed, all their internal records vanished. We don't know whether they were hidden or whether they were suppressed by the Inquisition. So what we know about the Templars is based on facts that have been emerging ever since, very slowly, and also reasonable speculation, bearing in mind the nature of the people who founded the order.
Mm-hmm. Well, history being written by the victors, obviously, if the Templars are not publicly around to correct the record or provide counter-evidence, the only history we really have on the Templars is the church, I would imagine.
Officially, that's the situation. And, we're back to Churchill's old adage that history is a pack of lies agreed by the victors in any situation. But there are other aspects of history which I call the hidden hand of history. You find it in myth, in legend, in folk tradition, in folk song, in local traditions. And that starts to tell a very different and far more consistent story.
And that's the sourcing for, apparently, your works of, the last, 40 years?
It's, it starts to tell you where to look. It's not so much a sourcing, it's more a set of signposts. And then you will find that for financial reasons, various government institutions in Europe, on mainland Europe, not so much in England, they recorded everything. If it was taxable, it was recorded. So you have phenomenally accurate records of births, deaths, marriages, bequests, wills, and everything else. And you'll be surprised what you can learn from that.
So you just are picking your way through a very dense paper trail and looking for little signposts up ahead, as Rod Serling used to say.
That's absolutely it. And also the other thing that people tend to forget, they tend to project their present-day belief system backwards in time. That doesn't work. It gets in the way. You have to try and come to terms with, for example, if you're looking at the Knights Templar, what did ordinary people believe? What did they trust? What did they fear back in the 12th century, 800, 900 years ago? And you've got to try and get as near into that mindset as you possibly can to begin to understand what was happening.
Well, in terms of the Templars, I mean, the public story is that they were formed as part of the Crusades. Nine courageous knights going off to Jerusalem, to the Mideast, to protect pilgrims, etc. What do you think the real story is?
For the real story, you have to go back to the time of Jesus.
All the way back
there. And in fact, about 100 years before him. At that time, the temple in Jerusalem was staffed by 24 hereditary priestly families who were known collectively as the Mamadot, the Kohenim. Mm-hmm. The Greeks defiled the temple about 100 years before Jesus was born. And the Mamadot deserted the temple and founded their own community, which was based at Qumran. They became known as the Essenes. Mm-hmm. Now, Jesus was one of them. He wasn't Jesus of Nazareth, because Nazareth didn't bloody well exist at that time. He was Jesus the Nazarene. He was a member of an initiatory order which was part of the Essene tradition. When Jerusalem fell in AD 70 and the temple was destroyed, the Essenes scattered, those who survived, and they knew that the shit was hitting the fan and that they were marked men. So they decided to stay together in communication, kept their same Kohenim marital traditions. In other words, they married within the family groups and not outside. That's how they became traceable. And they would outwardly practice the religion of the time, but secretly pass on the Essene teaching from father to children down through the ages.
So Philip the Fair and the Pope, Pope Clement, who basically attacked the Templars, their news peg for why that the Templars were actually heretics, from their point of view, they were correct.
To a certain extent, there's a lot of truth in that, yes. Because the Templars were founded by a small family group of people, descendants of the Mamadot, family group that are known in Western history as Rex Deus. And they were responsible for the founding of the Knights Templar. And if you check the original list of the founders, you'll find they were all related to one another. And the leaders of the Templars throughout their history were all members of the same family groups.
And because of the record keeping in Europe, you can now use that.
You can trace them. You can see where they intermarried.
Exactly. Wow. So it really is following a detective trail to its ultimate, whatever the conclusion is.
Yeah, and there is a gap between the fall of the Roman Empire and about the 10th century, because record keeping was incomplete or non-existent. But from the 10th century onwards, the record keeping is immaculate.
Hmm. Okay, hold
and
it.
It's the same families.
Can we hold it there? Because we've got a break coming up. Yeah. My guest this morning is Tim Wallace Murphy. And we're discussing spirituality, but we're discussing institutions that kind of get in the way of spirituality. and the fate of the Templars. We will pick up the fate of the Templars and where they went wrong and where they may have gone right, right after these messages. We'll be back. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Don't go away.
We all want the stars, but they don't seem to change.
Welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight. My guest this morning is Tim Wallace Murphy. We're discussing spirituality, and we kind of left you hanging on the Templars and the fate. Tim, do you think that the rumor about the fleet escaping to the New World is accurate?
We have absolutely no evidence for that whatsoever. It's pure fantasy.
You sound rather emphatic about that.
Yes, I am. I'm extremely annoyed at people who clutter up the literature with Templar attributions and stories which have no foundation in fact. Speculation is necessary, but it has to have some factual basis, and it also has to have an understanding of the circumstances of the time. What do we know about the Templar treasure that vanished? When Jacques de Molay arrived in Paris, he disobeyed orders issued by the French king to travel light, and he arrived with a large contingent of people, and there were at least 18 pack horses loaded with silver bullion taken into the temple. That's a fact. Mm-hmm. When the king's men went to the temple after the arrests, on October the 13th, the temple was empty. So where did the money go? We have evidence that it went in three different directions. A Belgian professor put out a lovely, well-documented theory about 10 years ago that part of it was taken north to Belgium and to what is the Low Countries, which are now Holland, in a cart covered in hay. Another third of it is supposedly somewhere in the south of France, non-specified.
Hmm.
And the remaining third was taken to La Rochelle and taken to Scotland. Now, I would love to find proof that the Templars reached North America. I'm very, very convinced in my inner being that that probably happened. But I have no proof, and neither does anybody else.
Have you been watching this unfolding saga of Oak Island?
Oh, the Oak Island mystery is a fascinating piece of hokum.
Wait. FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when he was Secretary of the Navy, got involved in the Oak Island mystery.
Well, this is part of the mystery. Why did so many brilliant businessmen who'd survived in the harsh world of competitive capitalism go bankrupt, sinking their bloody hard-earned millions into the Oak Island mystery? It's fascinating.
Is that a rhetorical question, or do you have an answer?
It is a rhetorical question.
Okay.
We don't know whether it was greed, or it was just the fascination of the hunt, or what. We haven't the faintest bloody idea. But everything has been thrown at the Oak Island mystery as possible explanations. The Sinclairs have been attributed to it. The Templars, piracy, and piracy is probably the most logical answer, because a treasure fleet carrying pay for British forces in North America vanished once.
Oh.
So it could be that. But nobody bloody well knows.
Hmm.
And it's fascinating. But
But then if no one knows, how come a lot of people, as you said, a lot of bright people, a lot of people who'd made money, have been very successful and all that, how come they, you know, kind of locked onto that idea that the Templars had gone west?
They didn't. What they locked onto was the idea that whoever had constructed this very complex and very, very clever piece of engineering to protect something had buried something of immense value. That's what they've locked onto. Now, the speculation comes from outside that realm. It's the people who are trying to find explanations for it and who are throwing everything at it by the kitchen sink and the tooth fairy. The short answer is, I don't know who made the pit at the money pit at Oak Island. I remember the last time I was there, the guy who owned it at that time tried to interest my patron in investing $850,000 in further exploration. The thing has become obsessional for so many people, and I'm as curious as anybody else to know what was there.
Well, you know that there are two brothers that bought the island a few years ago, and there's now a major television network which has been funding the expedition year after year and filming it and putting it on season after season with all kinds of technology and inbred experts and outbred experts, and it's really great television, and they're making some progress. They've actually gotten through some of these traps, and they're using robotics, and they're looking at things that no one's seen before. But the Templar aura around that project is very palpable.
No, the Templar aura there is totally artificial.
Okay.
So have they found one Templar artifact?
I'm trying to remember, because I've been trying to watch this, you know.
The answer is no.
Okay.
The parallel situation here happened about 120 years ago.
When you say you mean Rennes-les-Châteaux?
No. I'm talking about the Temple Mount in Jerusalem.
Oh, okay.
And excavations in the tunnels there, conducted by Lieutenant Warren of the Royal Engineers. He dug down under the Temple Mount and found a shaft had been bored through the rock for over 90 meters. And then there were radiating tunnels at the bottom. And he found Templar artifacts within them.
Okay. Well, that's not surprising, because we know they were stationed there.
Yeah, and they had the time. Now, that's the sort of proof we need before you can say the Templars did it.
Okay.
And that proof does not exist yet, and probably doesn't anyway. I think that whole construction is 17th or 18th century. That's my guess.
Okay. Well, if they find something, obviously we'll have you back. And if they don't find something, we'll have you back, and we can talk about it. I want to move the conversation in the direction of the reason why we wanted to do this show tonight. Because the Templars were the first, I think I'm accurate, besides the Crusades, they were the vanguard of a push from Europe into the Middle East, and the Middle East, of course, Saracens, etc., pushed back. Is that the beginnings of this incredible nightmare we've been living through for the last, 15, 20 years?
It certainly contributed to it. If you look at this from the Muslim perspective, the original crusade in 1095, this was before the Templars were founded, was a bloodbath. And it was unjustified in their eyes, because pilgrims were actually allowed to go to Jerusalem.
By the Muslims?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
that was a cover story?
Yeah, that was a cover story. The whole deal was Western Christianity, the Catholic Church, saw an opportunity to conquer and absorb not merely the Holy Land, but the Eastern Church, the Orthodox Church.
Mm-hmm.
And Byzantium. This was the name of the game. Now, the Templars were founded after the fall of Jerusalem. Now, when Jerusalem fell in 1099, the Christian forces reveled in the fact that their horses were wading knee-deep in blood.
Mm.
They slaughtered everybody, Muslim, Christian, Jewish alike. The Jews who fled to the synagogue, they simply barred the doors and they set the synagogue alight. It was a bloodbath. when Salah ad-Din retook Jerusalem for the Muslims a century or more later, he offered ransom to all the people at a level they could afford. And if they couldn't afford it, he paid it out of his own pocket so his troops would still get paid. He was issued orders that no church or place of worship should be despoiled. And it's the contrast between those two things which gives you the idea of how the Muslim world view the Crusades. It should also be remembered that while landless robber barons were invading the Holy Land from Europe, their elder brothers were sitting at the feet of Islamic scholars in Spain trying to learn a few things. So there was this stark contrast all the time. Christianity is the most jealous religion on God's earth. When the church was first founded and legalized under Constantine, the first thing they did was close down all the temples. It brooks no opposition. Now you contrast that with the world of Islam, where in Spain, at a time when Charlemagne couldn't write his name, there was a university at Cordoba that was fed by schools from Jewish communities, from Christian communities, and from Muslim communities. 2,000 books a year were published. There were studies of science, philosophy, medicine, and Europe was still in the Dark Ages. It's a total contrast in attitude. So much of the problems we have today with the world of Islam, because of its oil bearing, this is why we're constantly poking our bloody nose in, have their historical roots in the Crusades. And one of these days we're going to pay an awful bloody price for that.
Did you ever see one of the Robin Hood films on with Kevin Costner?
Many years ago, yes.
Okay. Do you remember the most striking for Western audiences aspect of that film?
Yeah, there was a Muslim involved.
Yes, played by a very incredible actor. Oh, incredible actor. And what happens during the film is that every time they come to a high point, the Muslim, who has attached himself to Costner because he saved his life and he kind of owes him a debt and, reciprocity, he keeps whipping out examples of Islamic science and cutting-edge knowledge that Europe has zero knowledge of.
That's right.
Including a portable telescope. Remember the portable telescope scene?
That's right, yeah.
And Costner holds it up as Robin Hood and he jumps back because suddenly things are three times bigger and they're three times closer. But centuries before Galileo, Islam was doing science, and that is the only mainstream representation I can think of where that history was accurately reflected in an ordinary popular film.
And done very cleverly.
Very cleverly. Morgan Freeman. Yeah. Morgan Freeman.
That's right.
Brilliant performance in that role.
But do you understand the rationale behind the difference between Christianity and Islam and looking at science? You see, the church wanted an ignorant laity who did as they were told. And to keep the clergy busy, they indulged in the sport of theology, the study of God. Mm-hmm. And there was, in the 11th or 12th century, there was a four or five-day convention on the island of Minorca or Mallorca to study the serious question of how many angels can you sit on the head of a pin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is at a time when Islam said the study of God is lunacy because no human being can understand the mind of God.
How can the effable understand the ineffable?
You got it. So therefore, if you want to know about God, study his works in nature. So they became scientists. They became inquirers. They became researchers. Europe's first medical school was founded not very far from here, where I am now, at a place called Montpellier, by Jewish doctors who'd been trained in Moorish Spain and North Africa. Our philosophy is based on the philosophy of Averroes, who was born in Cordoba and who worked in Morocco. He was the father of philosophy for the medieval schoolmen of the Middle Ages. You know, people like Aquinas, they referred to him as the master. Our knowledge of astronomy came from Muslim Spain. Our knowledge of the Greek classics, which had been suppressed for the first 1,000 years of Christianity, they were translated not from Greek, but from Arabic by Jewish scholars in Spain, because the Arabic people had treasured the works of the classics. We would know nothing about Plato, Socrates, or Pythagoras if it wasn't for that. The contrast is startling. They shared their knowledge with us, and all we did was try and slit their throats. And we're still doing it.
Yep. Well, this is why I wanted you on tonight, because to me, this schism, this clash of civilizations, is at the heart of the 21st century problem. Unless it's resolved, what we see going on CNN and Fox and MSNBC nightly is going to go on forever.
Yeah. Well, the answer is very, very simple. If you believe in a God, as most of us do, then you need to recognize we are all children of the same God. And the situation was summed up by that wonderful man, Martin Luther King Jr., when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize. He said, "We have learnt to fly in the air like birds. We have yet to learn to walk on the earth like brothers." That's what it's all about. That's the issue at the heart of spirituality. That is the principal objective of the worldwide craft of Freemasonry, to teach people to treat each other like brothers, as we really are, irrespective of their religion or their color or their age. This is the fundamental teachings of Jesus.
Okay, the problem I'm having in understanding what's currently going on in the House and the Senate on terms of this treaty is that there seems to be, on the part of Western politicians, a lot of them, not everybody, but a lot of them, and thereby a lot of people who follow their lead, this kind of blind hatred of Iran as a nation, as a people, as a place, very similar to our appropriate hatred of Nazism and what they did. I mean, there's almost an equivalence being put forward that these are unscrupulous people, they can never be trusted, you can't turn your back, they're out to slit our throats, nothing they do will ever stand, they won't abide by, you know, contracts or treaties or agreements or anything. In other words, every time I see a group or a people or a civilization that is so castigated, that's so focused upon with such hatred, my curiosity says, what the hell's really going on here?
Yeah, and you're right. It's the right questions to ask. Ask yourself this one. Who have Iran ever invaded?
Nobody.
Right. What have they got that we want?
Not very much.
Oil?
Well, no, but Iran doesn't really have all that much oil.
Oh, you're joking. It's one of the biggest potential producers in the world.
But we've sealed it off.
Yes,
so that nobody can get it.
But it's still there.
Okay, well, that presumes that oil is going to go on forever, and technologically it's not.
No, but again...
Unless the groups that are, you know, fronting this and, you know, pushing it forward have a plan to make sure oil is forever.
Yeah, they want to maximize their profit for as long as they possibly can.
Okay.
So oil is an asset. And also, Iran has committed a very big cardinal sin. It stuck its thumb against its nose and wagged its fingers at the West and said, "We're not going to have your puppet ruler. We're going to have our own."
Mm-hmm. You mean the overthrow of the Shah?
Yep.
Which was put in place by what, the CIA?
No, the French had the Shah had been propped up by the West ever since the Shah of Persia became a ruling post. It was a totally artificial situation, and he was a Western ally who did what he was told. And when democracy started in Iran, and they elected a prime minister called Mossadegh. The British conspired against him and had him fired. And the, Iran could have become a democratic country at that point. That was back in the late 40s, early 50s. The Shah dictatorship carried paid. And like all revolutions, it doesn't matter whether it's revolutions of the right or the left, it simply replaced one form of tyranny with another. But here they were replacing a form of tyranny that the West approved of with one that they didn't.
Hmm.
End of story.
Hmm. Why do I get the impression in looking at the Iran situation that we really need to go much farther back than the Islamic period? We need to go back to Zoroaster, the Persians, that whole enclave of power and knowledge. And in other words, I'm looking for the deeper roots of this antagonism between civilizations, focused now on this little country.
That's a pretty wise approach, and you'll get some surprises along the way if you start investigating.
That's what you're here for. So surprise me.
There is a place in northern Iran called Jundishapur. It became a place of refuge for the Nestorian scholars of Greece who were expelled from Christian Europe. And this is where the Arab treasuring, or the Arabic-speaking treasuring of Greek classics started. It was also a center of science and civilization. Zoroastrianism is probably the earliest and most effective form of initiatory spirituality of which we have record.
Mm.
There's a lot to be looked at there, and how one interprets it is going to a certain extent reflect one's own state of bias. And let's be blunt, we all have bias.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is to try and eliminate it as much as possible. There is a principle which was enshrined by Herbert Spencer many years ago. He said, there is a principle which is a barrier against all knowledge, which, if applied, is bound to keep mankind in everlasting ignorance. And that principle is contempt prior to investigation.
Mm.
And what the media does is instill us with contempt prior to investigation. So we don't look at things with an open mind.
Well, look at how many people are against this treaty.
Yeah.
Although I don't think it's technically a treaty, it's some other, I don't know what the technical term would be, but they've been against it just because it exists, as opposed to reading it and looking at the details.
And also they're against it because it's far more profitable for them to go to war.
Well, that's obviously. I mean, we're kind of on a roll when it comes to going to war. And what's intriguing to me is that almost single-handedly, this president has stood in the doorway, like Wallace, mixing our metaphors madly, and he's said, in effect, no, over my dead body are you going to go to war again? We're going to do something different this time. And he has been assailed from every side for trying to save thousands, if not tens of thousands of people, and maybe a global nuclear holocaust if the big powers get involved, like Russia on their side, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, why is the hatred of this little country so damn deep?
Well, I'd ask a far more fundamental question if I was an American.
Okay.
Why is hatred and violence the first response of political parties in your country?
Well, not all parties, but...
Not all, but a startlingly high percentage of them. When viewed from Europe, we see political pronouncements from the Republican Party potential candidates, and we don't know whether to laugh or to cry.
Hmm. See, that's what makes me fascinated by Donald Trump, because in this field of very rabid conservative Republican candidates, each stumbling over each other to be more antagonistic and resolute and determined on the Iran situation, Trump is kind of weird because he says, no, I won't tear up the thing. I'm going to enforce it, which, of course, is the rational, appropriate approach to heading off World War III.
Yeah, well... When you think about it, when you get somebody as bizarre as Trump, occasionally being rational. It's hilarious. I mean, the real dream ticket there would be Trump for candidate and Palin for vice.
Oh, my God.
You know, no, I've been a political animal all my life, and I was involved in politics in England for many years, and I used to think that the British electorate were the most naive crowd of klutzes on God's earth, until I started to study American politics. Mm. And by, you make the Brits look like intellectual giants.
Well, I must say the current debate has not been very edifying for anybody.
Well, no, none of them have been for a very considerable time. The last decent Republican president you had was Eisenhower.
Yep. As I was saying last night, my grandfather and grandmother revered him because they had these plaques on both sides of the fireplace, him and Nixon. And yes, I mean, during a period where we were incredibly balanced on the knife edge of are we going to survive or go to global war, Eisenhower did all kinds of things to lay the framework for what Kennedy eventually pulled off in the way of agreements with, you know, these bitter, horrible. So we have done this before, but there are very few rational voices. I mean, there are obviously some, like the president and people, you know, who are thinkers. But everybody else seems to forget that we survived in a situation where the Soviet Union could have annihilated us. Unless we had come to the table and come to terms.
Yes, and both sides did come to the table.
So why aren't there wiser heads on both sides saying, you know, when Obama prophesied this during the campaign 7-8 years ago, he said, I'm going to talk. And he was castigated for simply wanting to talk. Again, why are we focused like a laser on this little spot of real estate and the folks who run it who are part of something much deeper in history that I think we need to get out in the open, because that, to me, might be the key to answering the question.
I think the real key is, why are you focused on war, war, war all the time? It's because you're a lot of people who have the money do not believe your economy will continue to prosper unless the armaments industry is constantly busy.
Hmm.
I think it's as simple as that. And Iran just happens to be the next potential target. It could be anywhere else.
Hmm. Okay. I'll tell you what, hold it there. We have a break coming up, and we'll pick up our conversation this morning with my guest, Tim Wallace Murphy, and the discussion of the Middle East, Iran, the clash of civilizations, and hopefully some ways out. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we'll be right back.
Instead of what you needed to hear, blaming the rain, like yelling at a ghost, like the call that doesn't come, and then cursing the phone, like punching the wall, hoping I'm the one that bleeds. It's like the
And we are back. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Tim Wallace Murphy, and we're discussing Islam and the West and the conflict. You know, this book, What Did Islam Do For Us? Why don't you go through the high points that you wanted to get across? Because I think that one of our main problems is our electorate, our constituencies, the various people who follow various parties over here, they basically have no knowledge of Islam beyond a few nuts that do weird, wild things and then obviously tar everybody else with the same stupid brush.
Well, first of all, I wrote that book because I was furious. I'd long been aware of the intellectual debt that Western culture owes to the world of Islam.
If you can get just a little closer to your mic.
And I was utterly furious at the ease with which Bush and Blair led their peoples into an illegal war and an unnecessary war in Afghanistan and then later in Iraq. That's why I wrote the book. to refute that. And I was trying to get through to the electorate, both in the UK and in the US, a different perspective. And to my intense horror, because it has Islam in the title, my publishers, distributors in the States virtually refused to sell the book.
Hmm.
And apart from Amazon and books that I brought over myself on my visits, I don't think any books have got through to the States. This is the level of prejudice that exists. A friend of mine who is has an Indian mother and is therefore a little colored, was on a subway train in Montreal carrying a copy of that book, and people started to move away from him.
Hmm.
That's the level of prejudice that exists. And then we have, in contrast, Islamic mosques raising funds to help rebuild some of the black churches that were recently burnt down. How much publicity is that getting?
None.
Yeah. There is your bias. They've raised over $100,000 to help people of a different religion rebuild their places of worship on the basis that all places of worship should be sacred and safe.
Hmm.
That is the true tolerance of Islam. Yes, there are Islamic fundamentalists, and we are actually funding them. Not through the CIA, but every time you put gas in your tank that comes from Saudi Arabia, the rulers of Saudi Arabia are from an extremist sect called the Wahhabi.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they live it up. They have their lady friends, they have their gambling, they have their rich lifestyle, but as a sop to their conscience, they're funding extremist madrasas right throughout the Muslim world.
Isn't that lifestyle kind of antithetical to Islam?
Yes, of course it is. But this is it. To solve their consciences, they are funding extremist bloody schools throughout the Muslim world. So we, in a sense, are funding the authors of our own demise. It's a crazy situation. When you study history, you will find that from the time of Muhammad until the early 20th century, a startlingly high percentage of Jewish population in the world lived voluntarily under the rule of Islam because they felt safe, they felt tolerated, they felt treasured and respected, which they didn't feel in Europe. It's only recently that the shit's hit the fan and things have started to change, but they've only started to change in one or two nasty places. And we are going to pay an awful price for the Zionist treatment of the Palestinian people, amongst other things. And there is part and parcel of why there's so much bias in American and British media. The power of lobbies like AIPAC cannot be underestimated. It seems to be fading a little, otherwise we wouldn't have the Iran deal. But it's very, very dangerous. And Netanyahu at one stage boasted that the American government will do precisely what he tells it because of AIPAC. So who are you electing? Are you electing representatives of the American people, or are you electing spokespeople for AIPAC?
Hmm.
And as AIPAC funds people on both sides of the political fence, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, as Trump has said, they fund all sides because you don't know who's going to win and you want to place your bets so everybody wins.
Yeah, so AIPAC win, whichever. Whoever's elected is one of their creatures.
You have a line in your book in the introduction which I find fascinating. You say, within the Quran, the Holy Quran, Christians and Jews are described as the people of the book.
That is correct.
And treated with respect and toleration.
Yeah.
How did this historical legacy, which is there if you just look, how did it get turned upside down? Is it because we just don't read anything?
It's only turned upside down in the Western world.
But Europe did go along with the Bush War and then the...
Yeah,
you know.
It did. This is why I got so bloody angry. You see, in a sense, I could forgive the naivety of the American government for invading Afghanistan. They'd never been there before.
Mm.
or they'd been operating from behind the scenes when the Russians were there and they'd funded the Taliban and all the rest of it. They'd never actually fought on the ground. I couldn't forgive the Brits. They'd tried to invade Afghanistan at least twice and got a bloody nose on both occasions. They didn't learn from history.
Okay. And obviously we followed their lead, I guess.
Yeah. And got the same result. Isn't that the
definition of insanity?
That's right. Doing the same thing time and time again and expecting a different result.
So where do we go from here? How do we break this horrible cycle we're in?
Ultimately, local perceptions, national perceptions, global perceptions are the cumulative effect of individual attitudes. We need to, as individuals, become more tolerant and more respectful of other people's beliefs. We need to follow the basic principles that were enshrined in Moorish Spain of respect and understanding for people of different faiths and different colors and different cultures. As I said earlier, we're all children of the same God, and we should learn from each other. We should respect each other, not treat each other with contempt and derision. It takes time, but more and more people are becoming aware of the blind prejudice that fuels unnecessary and brutal wars. And there is a reaction setting in. It'll take time, but everything that encourages peace and brotherhood, Freemasonry, spirituality, the group of programs that the Dalai Lama called the greatest gift America has given the world, the 12-step recovery programs, all of these encourage brotherhood and mutual respect. All religions should do, but sadly don't. How come so many fundamentalist Christians preach hatred? Hatred of other religions, hatred of people of different sexuality or different color. What has that to do with the commandment of love thy neighbor as thyself? You know, these are the questions we need to be answering and learning to live by the answers that we get. There's not a quick fix anywhere. It's a matter of, Mahatma Gandhi said it, be the change you want to see in the world.
Well, one of the ways that you break down barriers is obviously through communications.
Yeah.
And we live in a world now where communication is so easy anywhere. I mean, this program literally is carried worldwide. Anybody on the planet can tune in. You're there in the south of France. I've got guests tomorrow from England. I've got, you know, folks that have been here from South Africa, from the Far East. If it were not for the mullahs in Tehran, would we not have a flowing conversation, a dialogue between ordinary Americans and ordinary Iranians? I mean, heck, we've actually put one of the Iranians in space. Yeah, in the space station a few years ago.
Yeah, well, don't forget that there is actually communication between ordinary people in Iran and people in America.
It doesn't percolate up to the political, you know?
It's not publicized. For example, we've had a worldwide financial crisis a few years ago.
Yes.
Britain bailed out the banks. America bailed out the banks, the people who'd caused the problems. In Iceland, they sacked the politicians, imprisoned the bankers, forgave their internal debt, reneged on their external debt, and they're now prosperous. How many people know that?
Very few.
The media are controlled by a very small group of people who use it to reflect their own bias and their own prejudice.
Are you talking about our media or worldwide?
Worldwide. It's not just an American problem. Rupert Murdoch is not only a kingpin in American media, he controls an awful lot of British media as well, in fact, nearly all of it. This is a worldwide problem. It's an inherent problem in the capitalist system.
But wait, he doesn't control the BBC.
No, but the BBC is controlled by the Conservative government, which is not very much different.
Hmm.
The BBC is no longer a truly independent situation. It tends to reflect government policy.
Hmm.
It's almost a parallel situation to Soviet Russia in the old days.
Well, speaking of that, there is this interesting political revolution going on in Britain now. The Labour Party is putting forth a new leader, and he's kind of as far out there as our Bernie Sanders on
base.
Go ahead.
Let's muddy the waters of that discussion with a few basic truths.
Okay.
The Labour Party was originally founded to look after the interests of ordinary working people.
One would think.
And it did. And it did its best to do that. And because of the Labour Party, we had a national health service. We had nationalised industries whose profits kept taxes down. We had a free educational system that worked right up to and including university level, where people were paid to go to university. Then that was destroyed. It moved to the right.
Was this then during the Thatcher era?
Yep, just before Thatcher. That's when the shit started to hit the fan. And Thatcher put the nail on it. Now, with a bit of luck, it might be going back to what it was founded for. Bernie Sanders talks good sense. You showed me a reason why America, one of the richest countries in the world, is 37th in the level of health care in the developed world.
And there are a lot of politicians who keep saying, oh, we're number one, and they obviously haven't looked at the stats.
They don't know what they're talking about. You are almost number one in child poverty levels in the developed world. Now, this is scandalous, and only one politician is speaking out about it, Bernie Sanders. Now, here in France, it doesn't matter whether we have governments of right, left, or centre. There are certain core values of health care and social security which are sacrosanct. Nobody touches them.
Well, before Social Security was put in under FDR, there was a huge opposition, and every possible horrible thing was projected to happen if that came to pass, if the legislation was approved, it was signed by the president. And now, of course, you have Republicans, even Tea Party Republicans, who, when the discussion turns around to reining in these long-term commitments, the so-called entitlements, They say, with a perfectly straight face to pollsters, don't you dare let the government put their hands on my Medicare or my Social Security.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there should be more people like that. You see, a civilized country should be judged by the way it looks after the only guaranteed renewable resource it's got, are its people. And if your people are not healthy, if your people are not well-educated, you're screwed.
Or if you're following, in your model, the church model, you want to dumb them down and keep them what, in the basement, in the dark, so they will do what you want them to do.
Yeah. In a free society, we should care for each other. You see, the spiritual path I follow is known as the way of love, compassion, and service. Now, love and compassion are very noble sentiments, but that's all they bloody well are until they translate into service to people of less fortunate than myself. We have responsibilities to one another. Every spiritual path known to mankind teaches us that. The great religions talk about it. What we have forgotten is a principle first enunciated by Henry Thoreau about 150 years ago. Live your beliefs and you can turn the world around.
Well, have you noticed that authenticity is the new buzzword? That people are flocking to people who are real? Even people like Donald Trump.
He's honest.
People perceive he believes what he is saying, and he's not ideological. On the one hand, remember, he was touting a few days ago the efficacy of public health care in Scotland and I forget where else. And at the same time, he's talking about upholding the treaty with Iran. And yet the Tea Partiers and the conservative wing, the ultra-conservative wing, are following him because they think he's honest.
Yeah, well, as I say, I've been a political animal all my life. And the number of honest politicians in Britain that I can remember, I can number on the finger of one hand. And I don't think it would be very much different if I started to apply the same standards to your country. The whole political system in any country is open to corruption. And the trick is to get more and more ordinary people involved in policy making, so that you're discussing real policy, not personalities, not who's going to bed with who.
It's so interesting you say that, because I saw an interview this evening with Bernie Sanders where he said President Obama's big mistake after he was elected with this acclaim and this extraordinary historical transition and everybody's hopes and everybody, I mean, you could see people all over the world crying at the idea of this man elected and what he was going to do. And what Sanders said is the mistake, the major mistake that Obama did, he basically said to all those people, okay, you can go home. I've got it from here.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm not going to make that mistake. When I'm elected, notice his confidence, and I think the poll numbers are really interesting, he said, I'm going to involve the people in maintaining their democracy, because if we don't get them involved and keep them involved, they're not going to have a democracy.
Well, take that one step further. Take a good long look at your constitution. America is one of the few so-called democratic countries where the mechanism of the constitution allows the people to speak at more often than just at election times. It allows them to put propositions forward from grassroots level. Now, start using that.
Oh, wait. I'm not sure that I follow you, because our Constitution does not allow that. There are various states where referenda have the voice of law, but the national Constitution, the Constitution of the United States of America, would need a constitutional amendment to allow that.
If your states allow it, then use it, because this does not exist anywhere else.
Really?
No. This is one of the few things I'm envious about. Looking at it from a European situation. Here, if we want to put policies forward, you have to join a political party and kick the policies up through the whole bloody bureaucratic system and the pious hope you might get it adopted, maybe.
Well, the interesting thing about Sanders and Trump is that these two leaders on both sides of the aisle, as we say over here, they're actually proposing policies that are not ideological.
No.
And people are look, Bernie Sanders supposedly is a socialist. Well, over here, being a socialist is one step above being, I don't know, a baby burner or something. And
yes,
yet,
well, that's a misconception.
Nobody cares.
That is a misconception that has been foisted on the American people as an offshoot of McCarthyism.
And we now know from the polls, the people don't give a damn if Bernie says he's a socialist, because they want what he's saying he wants to do, regardless of the label, which is a breath of fresh air and sanity in what looks like almost, you know, the clown car of elections coming.
Sadly, I don't think he's got a snowball's chance in hell of getting elected. I hope I'm wrong.
Now, why would you say that? If you look at the world, we're going through such ferment. I mean, the so-called Arab Spring was a leading edge of people at the grass. I mean, the whole situation in Syria was basically people revolting against Assad and not realizing that he would do anything to stay in power.
But they didn't learn from his history and his father.
But the inclination, Tim, what I'm saying is the inclination is there, and I'm watching our situation because I'm a little closer. And I feel a lot more optimistic that this is a real revolution, because they're tossing labels left and right aside and they're pursuing objectives.
Well, thank God that is happening. But I don't think the system is conducive to the election of Bernie Sanders. But where he is going to score is that people are not going to forget what he is proposing. And one way or another, these things are going to happen.
Hmm.
This is where the real sea change is going to be. I would love to see him as president. I really would. I mean, I'd be quite blunt. I'm an old-fashioned socialist from way back. I've never made any secret of it.
How could I have gleaned that? Yes.
Yeah. But I'm all for the little guy. You see, The whole economic system depends on ordinary working people and skilled people and the guys who sweep the streets. And they are entitled to a fair crack of the whip, because on their labor depends everything else.
Everything, yes.
Yeah. They hold the whole bloody system up, and they've always had the worst end of the stick.
Well, we have these cyclic waves of, left, right, left, right. The wave is turning. When I say wave, I'm actually not really talking metaphorically. I've been working on some physics that looks like it might be behind some of these consciousness shifts. But we're talking, Tim, about a real consciousness change. That the leadership of the Republican Party and the leadership of the Democratic Party, I mean, the Democrats are putting forth Hillary, and she's supposed to be the anointed one, right?
Yes.
And they put forth Jeb, and he's supposed to be the anointed one. Oh, my. That's an unnatural phenomenon, a Bush versus a Clinton.
Yeah.
Okay. And the people have said, are you nuts?
And the people will listen to. Well, because that's what democracy is supposed to be all about.
But see, the trend curves are changing, and the pollsters and the pundits and the folks in control, you know, sitting on the message, doing the spin doctoring and all that, they are so flummoxed. It's so fascinating to watch all these talk shows, which I do probably much too much, because I'm trying to get a handle on, are we at the cusp of a real fundamental populist revolution where we take back our own power?
I wouldn't call it a revolution. To quote Camus, no revolution ever existed that didn't replace one form of tyranny with another. It's a sea change of opinion. The people are beginning to awaken. This is a process that started about 35, 40 years ago and has been very gradually but very steadily picking up momentum. It was described in a book written by an American psychologist called Marilyn Ferguson, a dreadful title, the Aquarian Conspiracy.
Yeah, the Aquarian Conspiracy.
That process is now beginning to accelerate because of the internet. And it's no longer a national thing, it's an international one. And it's based on the disillusionment of young people. And they are our saviors.
Well, because they're not ideological. They're looking for what works, because they're looking for what's not working in their lives.
Yeah, that's it. And they're not prepared to have more of the same. And God bless them for it.
So you don't think this is going to crest in this election cycle here? You think it's going to be a kind of a prelude to the next 4 years or the 4 years after?
I honestly don't know. I'd love to see Sanders as president of the United States. I really would. Because his thing, it's not a case of party labels. It's a case of what he represents. Hmm. He's saying what the people need.
Absolutely.
And the people are agreeing with him. That's the key issue. So sooner or later, that's going to take on. And I hope and pray that similar things are happening in the Labour Party in Britain. Because the ordinary little guy in the street, without him, we're screwed. And if he's not looked after and given proper health care and decent education, he's not productive.
Well, see, that's why I was focusing on this to-be elected leader of the Labour Party, because he sounds very similar to Sanders, but on the other side of the pond.
Yeah, he is. It's basic socialism.
John, what's his name?
Corbyn.
John Corbyn, okay.
Yeah.
What do you think his chances are?
They're moving heaven and earth to stop it. And even if he gets elected, it won't guarantee anything, but it's a step in the right direction. You see, the name of the game is to provoke ordinary people into thinking and reminding them that true power originates with them.
Always. Ultimately.
That's where it comes from. It doesn't come out of the barrel of a gun. It doesn't come out of a bank account. It comes from ordinary people. And the people have been trained to forget this.
Mm. When, go ahead.
And provided the people find their voice, it doesn't matter whether they elect a government of right, left, or center. That's their choice. That's what democracy is supposed to be about. Mm.
When we come back, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about the refugee situation, because to me, this is one of the, even though there's a lot of stuff on the news, I don't think that the coverage is grasping the magnitude of what's going on and some of the systemic causes, which I think are much deeper than what's been described so far. So when we come back, let's kind of take a look at that, and we'll have your thoughts. And you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. My guest this morning is Tim Wallace Murphy. And we're basically discussing consciousness and how it affects our lives as expressed through the political process, among many other ways. We'll be right back.
Disappeared and my mask hit the ground with a scream.
We are back on the other side of midnight. Before we continue, I'd like to thank the Board X for posting our conversations and guests and programs and plans from the other side of midnight. A salute to you guys. Keep up the good work. Tim, this refugee situation, it has the magnitude of historical migrations in the face of huge changes. And we're being told that it's because Assad is barrel bombing his people and all that. Well, he's been doing that for a decade. Why all these people suddenly now? Why are they leaving and heading anywhere but there?
Look at the reality of the political and physical situation of the Middle East. It's not just Syria and Assad and the spillover into the Lebanon or into the fringes of Turkey. It's the failure of the Arab Spring, the putsch in Egypt, the Libyan situation. We have been bombing the hell out of these countries, or funding the bombing of them, and people are fleeing. They want to be safe. And we have a moral responsibility to look after them. And never forget that once this one dies down, if it dies down, it's going to be exaggerated again, because with the ecological crisis that we're facing, people will be fleeing looking for water.
Mm.
The next wars won't be over oil, they'll be over water. The whole thing's a mess. And again, it's back to basic spiritual principles. I am involved in mankind. These people are my brothers and sisters. I have a responsibility to help them.
Why is the reaction so... Why is it so incredibly disparate? I mean, we're a country of 300 and some million. We have a $15, $16, $17 trillion a year budget. And we're taking in 10,000 people. That was the big news today. We're going to take in 10,000 people, up from 1,200. And Germany is taking in 800,000. How can we pretend to be the leaders of the world when we're doing nothing compared to our resources, compared to countries? I mean, Lebanon has, what, taken in 1 million? And they have 4 million people, so they've taken in, you know, 20% of their entire population. What's wrong with this picture?
You're following a traditional historical pattern. Remember the record of both Britain and the United States in taking in Jews fleeing from Nazi Europe. It was appalling.
Appalling, yes.
Yeah.
But we actually turned them away. Remember that famous ship we turned away?
That's right. Well, Europe is beginning to wake up. European countries are saying, send us your people. And if the governments don't agree with it, the people are saying it. Again, Iceland is prepared to take people in. Scandinavia has got a wonderful record of helping displaced people. Western Europe is doing the same. Yes, it's causing problems, but those problems have got to be faced. We have responsibilities. I live in one of the poorest parts of France. It's one of the most beautiful, but the people down here are basically simple peasant farmers with very little surplus. Yet when the Spanish Civil War was going on in the 30s, they housed twice their own population of refugees. and did so willingly. It's basic law of humanity. We help one another. We're brothers and sisters. We're back to that again, this constant recurring theme. We're all children of the same God. What do the refugees want? Same things we want.
Of course.
Security, food on the table, a job, better chance for their kids. It's part of the human condition. And this blatant raw capitalism of you're responsible for yourself and nobody else, dog eat dog, that doesn't wash anymore.
But even the modern icon of capitalism, you know, Mr. Trump, you know, multi-billionaire, we're not quite sure how many billions he's got, but he's got a few more than I have. He said, he said, we need to take in these people. He said it.
Yeah.
And his constituency is following him because, Tim, it seems to me that we're now in the era where labels and parties and ideology is almost irrelevant. It's can you trust the guy or the gal?
Yeah. That's it.
And if the guy or gal looks at you and says, I don't agree with you, and this is why I don't agree with you, and if you want me to lead you, this is what I'm going to do, and they're following him because they're looking at someone who believes in what he's saying, who's authentic.
Yeah, well, this is it. He's perceived as being honest. There was an old French philosopher, Voltaire, who once said, there will be no peace on earth until we hang the last politician with the entrails of the last priest. He may have a point. I would like to think a little bit differently. You see, if people take
that actually, Tim, doesn't go along with the love your neighbor, etc., but go ahead.
No, it doesn't. But if people take the power back that is rightfully theirs, politicians will respond to it. They want to do a job. For a variety of reasons, some good, some bad, some indifferent, but they want to get elected. And if they don't do what the people want, they'll get thrown out with a bit of luck. The trouble with a two-party system is your choices are so limited. This is why I think Bernie Sanders is in problems in getting elected. But the man is doing a wonderful job in reflecting public opinion.
But have you seen his crowds? Have you seen him exceeding expectations? People are voting with their feet, and they're all colors and races and creeds and backgrounds and ages. It's like he represents, or his constituency represents people desperate for something that will work and won't wind up killing a lot more people.
That is his function, is to make sure that this situation is made manifest. But with your particular system, his chances of actually getting nominated by any of the great parties are pretty remote. And that is the problem.
Would you like to make a small side bet? I've kind of made my bones on making bets and winning them. Would you like to bet that maybe Bernie Sanders could be the nominee of the Democratic Party if Hillary continues in her free fall? I mean, I've looked at all kinds of Democratic, you know, politicos who are obviously desperate, and they're looking at Gore, and they're looking at the vice president, and they're looking at, you know, our Secretary of State, John Kerry, all guys who have, of course, run for president before. And then there's this kind of interesting figure in the wings saying nothing but smiling like a Cheshire cat, Elizabeth Warren. Is it not possible that Bernie Sanders could ride this wave to the White House?
I sincerely hope so, but I don't think he's got a snowball's chance in hell.
So do you want to make a side bet?
Yeah.
Okay, what will you set the stakes as?
Let's do it in something I can afford. I'll send you a signed copy of my next book if he gets the nomination.
Okay, and I'll send you a signed copy of my book if he doesn't get the nomination.
Yeah, you got a deal.
Okay. I want to break in. I want to read some comments because the emails are going crazy. For some reason, you're controversial. I can't imagine why. This one is from Kevin Scott. Bravo. Thank you, Mr. Hoagland. It took some courage to have Tim Wallace Murphy on this morning, and the truth he is telling tonight on your show. I'm sure that there will be those who are excoriating you and say they'll never listen again. But I say I'm glad you have the courage to have him on, and I'm thrilled to hear someone who tells the truth rather than bending to prejudice and hate. Thanks again, Kevin Scott.
Well, that's nice.
Isn't that nice? Now, you want me to read another one? On the other side?
Let's have the other side.
Oh, yes. We've got to have the other side here. Actually, this one's a little polite, but he says, let me get it up here. If my computer will work. Come on, come on. There we are. Okay. Richard, your guest tonight, though well-read, etc., to me, is a bit of an unbalanced sneerer when it comes to the Dark Ages and early medieval European Christianity. Their uncouth barbarism was more than matched by the barbarism of the founders of Islam, e.g., when a companion of Muhammad beheads the leader of the Persian forces and then raped his wife in blood-soaked soil, or perhaps the total elimination of the Christian and Buddhist population of Afghanistan, or the Buddhist population of northern India, where the main Buddhist university burnt for 3 days by these gentle science and poetry-loving Muslims. It is one of the premises of this following YouTube video that the collapse, and of course he sent a video, and lack of a rebound of the classic Western world, unlike with China of the same period, was the presence of Muhammad and his immediate successors. And
what
you
a
say,
load of crap.
Why don't you tell us how you really feel, Tim?
Okay,
where is it crap? Please take it apart piece by piece.
Okay. The Muslim empire was spread by the sword like any other empire. No different. However, the religion of Islam was not spread by the sword. When the Muslims conquered a country, they respected the beliefs of the people who were there. And people converted eventually to Islam over a long period of time because they respected the religion and the way it helped its people. It was no forcible conversions. For forcible conversions, you want to look to Christianity and to that wonderful man, St. Augustine of Hippo, who confected the doctrine of compel them to come in at the point of the sword. The pot here is calling the kettle black.
Well, we don't know that he's a Christian.
No, but you pretty fair guess. with that amount of bitterness, there's a pretty fair chance he's some sort of fundamentalist Christian, or possibly a fundamentalist Jew. There are some, but most Jews are far more tolerant than that.
Okay. I tell you what, do you want to answer some questions from the audience? Because I have another one here that I'm reading, and their complaint is that we haven't, you know, let them join the conversation. And it's not because I don't want to. It's because we just have 2 hours. We're trying to move to three. But this is such a complex subject, and you've done such interesting research in so many areas that I really felt we ought to give you the time to lay out the case and to argue certain specifics. But if you want to talk to people, you know, whatever you want to do.
Well, give me a couple of questions. Let's see what we can do with them.
Okay. Here's one from, well, it's actually just an email. It's Johnny from Pennsylvania. Richard, you have a guest on who is well-versed in esoteric subjects. I'd be happy to explain to him the problems with socialism and the lies of Bernie Sanders, who tells us we can have free education when nothing is free, and who pretends to help the little guy while ensuring a two-caste system of serfs and party members slash bankers. But that's not this guy's specialty. He's talking about you. He's openly attacked, meaning you, Catholicism and the Gospels, and nobody has had a chance to ask a single question. Trevor Ravenscroft was, from what I can tell, the last direct connection with the Steiner-Stein line of Grail Christianity. Their Christianity is aware that Jesus was real, died on the cross. In fact, Ravenscroft's mentor, Stein, claims to have memories of his past life as Joseph of Arimathea, including catching the blood of Christ in the Holy Grail. And you're asking this guy about Bernie Sanders? Open the lines, he says. So let us do that.
Let's knock out his first premise that free education is not possible. Free education existed in England from primary school level up to and including university level and postgraduate studies for over 35 years. It was brought about by a socialist government, and people were funded and paid to go to university. So it is achievable and it is maintainable. So there's his first premise straight out the bat. His comments about Christianity, I do not respond to that type of prejudice. May he study the record. Study the record of the Teutonic Knights forcibly converting people in the Baltic area. Study the record of the Inquisition. and then come back to me and say Christianity is a tolerant religion. Thank you.
Okay, we have someone on the phone. Who are you? Where are you calling from? And what would you like to ask my guest this morning?
Hey, good morning. This is Torch. How you doing?
Oh, hi, Torch. Hey.
I got a question. Does he know anything?
Back off your mic. You're a little hot. Back off.
Does he know about anything of Pope Ratzinger belonging to an organization called the Ninth Circle and also the Queen of England belonging to the same organization? And if they had heard anything about the Queen of England having passed away, but them keeping it secret?
I'm awfully sorry. I cannot answer any of those questions. I have no knowledge of them. And the Queen at this moment is unfortunately still alive and well. Her only useful function is she prevents us from the dreadful prospect of a President Cameron.
Okay, let's move on to our next call. By the way, I should give out the numbers for folks that may not know them by heart. The number here is 505-796-8802, 505-796-8802, and our Skype name is Enterprise Mission. I'm surprised, given the interesting range of the emails, that no one's calling to ask you directly. I mean, maybe they're more content to just write as opposed to speak.
Well, let's have a look at some of their written stuff.
Okay. Well, I just read you this one. Let me see what else has come in, because we have not yet set up a direct system for me to be able to dip into the audience. So I'm reading from my personal email here, which comes to me by way of the Enterprise Mission website, as well as othersideofmidnight.com. Okay, here's one. And I'm calling it up, and the computer should respond. It's really laggy tonight. Okay. This is from Scott in San Diego. The rhythm of his voice is not unlike that of my first grade teacher in 1960, an Irish Catholic nun, though I like his theology much, much better. And let's see who this is. Good morning. You're on the air. Give us your name and your location where you're calling from, and please turn down your device.
Hi, Richard. This is Kevin, the first email you read. I'm from Colorado.
Oh, Spring. Okay. And we've got Kevin on the air.
Real quick question for Mr. Murphy. I'm blind. Are any of your books on audio? And I'll take the answer off the air. I just wanted to know that because I would like to look it up.
All my publishing contracts allow my publishers the right to do audiobooks or braille copies, preferably free of charge. But I'll be quite honest, I don't know if that has been taken up.
Yeah, when I published my first book, I mean, you got, 14? That was one of the things that came up. And it turns out that it's a really complex technical process that you have to build into the contracts to make that happen.
Yeah, well, it's in all my contracts, but I don't know if it's been acted on.
Okay.
The writer very rarely gets accurate information from his publisher.
You have noticed that.
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Okay, let's add Scott to the conversation. Good morning. What would you like to ask Tim?
Well, good morning, Richard. Good morning, Tim. This is Scott, who was reminiscing about his Irish Catholic first grade teacher, the nun. And the question I've got is, you were talking about the when the British conspired with the American CIA in the 50s to overthrow Mossadegh. So many people in this country are totally unaware of that chapter and of so many other things that you all have been talking about. And it's just sad. We are woefully, we're pig ignorant, I think is the expression over here, a lot of us. Do you? I'm sure you agree, and maybe pig ignorant is too strong a designation, but good Lord, Agnes.
And that definitely is not doing any favors for the pigs.
Yeah,
well, no, it's an insult to the bovines. But it's sad. It makes you want to weep, some of these folks.
Well, unfortunately, the power of media is such, and it's concentrated in so few hands, that public opinion and public information is manipulated and filtered. I remember in our first book, The Mark of the Beast, Trevor and I wrote that with the advent of the information age, one of the ways of suppressing information was by flooding you with so much that you wouldn't notice what was going on. And this, sadly, has been going on for a very long time.
Well, do you know in this country that there's a whole publication industry, starting with the Inquirer and the Weekly Reader and a whole bunch of others, all out of Lantana, Florida, that from my information was systematically begun by the agency, by the CIA, as a fake set of news, as a fake set of journalism to counterpoint, you know, the Gray Lady and the Post and the major papers of the time, so that, again, people could not decide which was real and which was Memorex.
Well, they adopted a slightly different system in England. Trevor used to be a senior reporter on one of our national dailies, and every editorial office had a representative of the Secret Service. And if they said publish, the thing was published. If they said bin it, it was suppressed.
But you don't have a First Amendment.
No.
So that's much easier.
We don't have a constitution in Britain. You see, you're a citizen of the United States and you have a constitution which lays out your rights and obligations.
Yep.
I'm a subject of Her Majesty and I do as I'm told.
Hmm. Except you don't.
No. Well, I'm an Irishman, for God's sake. Being a rebel is an essential part of my equipment.
Okay. Anything else, Scott?
Yeah, very quickly. Yes, I'm aware of the history of the National Enquirer and the agency, CIA tentacles that were wrapped around that 50 years ago, 60, 70 years ago almost.
Yeah, but remember, our millennial audience has no clue of that history.
And that's the problem. And you were talking earlier about, Richard was, about the vast resources we have in instantaneous worldwide communication today. I'm a child of the 60s. I went to huge demonstrations against the war in the 60s, in the late 60s. We would have crowds typically on the streets of Washington of 500,000 people gathered together on the basis of a few underground newspapers, posters tacked up on the wall, and word of mouth. So we, with meager resources such as that 40-some years ago, we gathered huge, meaningful crowds that brought about change.
Yeah, but Scott, there was a huge difference, and you know what it is, and I'm going to enunciate it. Then we have the overthreat of the draft, and now there are huge segments of this society who will never see military service and therefore have no stake. They have no blood in the game, skin in the game. They skate on those who have to volunteer because that's their economic choice, because that's the only choice a lot of them have. But the idea that everybody serves and everybody has to be at risk and therefore everybody has a stake in not going to war, that's been removed.
But the underlying concept is the same in the sense that we have these tools and resources at our fingertips, and the best use we can make of it is to talk about the size of Kim Kardashian's ass.
Mm.
I mean, we should be rallying people together, and this show and art show are doing that.
Talk about making a mountain out of a molehill. Anyway.
But anyway, yeah, I'm sure you take my point.
Yes, but there is hope. You see, shows like this, and this is not the only one, the internet, even much derided Facebook, is a vehicle for people to comment. And they are beginning to communicate on a worldwide basis. And as a result, their horizons are broadening. 30 or 40 years ago, most people in your country hadn't been outside their own state, much less outside their own country. That is changing. And they're now communicating on a regular basis, daily, with people from different cultures and different backgrounds. This is healthy. You see, it's all about something I usually say at the beginning of a talk, if it's not an interview. I'm not here to educate you. I'm not here to inform you. I'm certainly not here to convert you from one flawed human belief system to another. My job is to act as an intellectual and spiritual agent provocateur and make you bloody well think. And this is the name of the game. People are being spoon-fed with pre-digested opinions. I want them to think for themselves because they're all capable of it.
Okay, Tim, we have another caller who's joined the conversation. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Hi there, Richard. This is Autumn from Indiana. And I just wanted to chime in on the Bernie Sanders debate. I would love for Bernie to get elected, but I 100% agree that there's no way the powers are going to let him be in office. I had this conversation back when Ron Paul was running with a bunch of friends of mine. They were all wholeheartedly convinced that he was going to be in office, but that didn't happen.
Well, it's going to be really interesting. And remember, my position is not on the merits. I'm looking at the process, at the flow of the process. And what I see, frankly, guys, is revolution. I see people so upset and so determined and so angry and getting so involved. And when you get enough people involved, nothing is impossible. Look at the party makers who are wringing their hands and tossing all kinds of bizarre, far-out possibilities. Oh, we could bring Al Gore back, or maybe we can get John Kerry to run. I mean, that tells me that there is such disarray behind the scenes on both sides that actually democracy may have a chance.
Well, let's hope you're right. But win, lose, or draw, the people are winning. Bernie Sanders is winning. Issues are being discussed which would have been suppressed 2 or 3 years ago. Things are coming out that people are disillusioned with politics, and this is being made manifest. And the policies that Sanders is proposing are all practicable. They're all attainable. And those policies are not going to vanish with his candidacy. So people are being inspired and hopefully will start to act. So one way or another, the American people will win because the debate has been changed. We now have a real political debate going on, whereas before it was a nonsense.
You know, for someone who's sitting there in the south of France, and I'm imagining all kinds of things, you obviously know a lot more about what we're doing maybe than we're doing. And unfortunately, that's our music and the program has come to an end. Tim, look. You and I are going to talk again. I'm going to have you back. I'm going to continue the conversation. I certainly want to thank you for being on the other side of midnight. And for the audience, I'll see you tomorrow morning in the outer solar system with some stunning imagery, some stunning, stunning new developments. And until then, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning.